comments about last night's show is welcome to call in today. It was an extraordinary hour with Tafiq Hamid, a man who had been a jihadist, a member of a terrorist cell led by Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's bin Laden's number two. We deliberately did not take callers because we wanted to get as much in with Mr. Hamid as possible. Our phones, however, my phone didn't stop ringing for an hour and 15 minutes. So first of all, I want to tell everybody, if you've got any thoughts, anything you want to get off your chest, any questions, feel free to call in about last night's show. Hey, today, how long is this issue going to continue to dominate so many programs like ours, so many newscasts? It's at least 50% of the time. And I said to them, well, how long did the last World War dominate the conversation? There's no choice. The issues are brought to us. We may want to get away from them. We may want to discuss other things. We may want to discuss the burden of government in our lives, high taxes, health care that doesn't work, but we're talking about survival. We're talking about survival of our civilization. We're talking about survival of our basic freedoms. That has to supersede everything. And stories push the issues. Whether we want to talk about them or not, they're in front of us. But sometimes you have to look at these stories in a different way. Today's news was led by the Parliament Hill hearings of RCMP Commissioner Zaccardelli about the Arar inquiry. And obviously the commissioner has had a fine career, and it was clear he didn't know the details of what was going on. But this was unacceptable. What bothered me, though, as I watched the hearing, and as I saw the headlines, is Zaccardelli apologizes. Our country seems to have a political culture, and this is not a knock on the RCMP commissioner, a political culture that becomes complicit in crimes of omission, and then that culture, the bureaucracy, the elected officials, seek absolution from those crimes of omission through false pieties of contrition, and usually not by those responsible. And what I mean is this. The Arar case was not a lone case. I think of Abdullah al-Malki. I think of other Canadian Syrians particularly, or Syrian Canadians, Canadian citizens, taken by Syria, tortured by Syria, and I want that question answered. What is it about Syria that let four Canadians be taken and Canada could do nothing? It's not. We understand the breakdown of the system. We understand that the information that was given to American authorities was acted upon wrongly. But there's the rub. Once acted upon wrongly, where was our government protecting our citizens? We're not talking about guilt or not of someone, but that guilt of a citizen or innocence of a citizen must be determined in his or her jurisdiction. And it took me back to the case of William Sampson, the Canadian, who languished for 2.5 years in a Saudi jail undergoing torture and gave scathing testimony to a House of Commons committee about how little Foreign Affairs was able to do, how little the ambassadors and the Canadian diplomats in Saudi Arabia were able to do, even in terms of visiting him. I'd like to know, not from the RCMP commissioner, I'd like to know, where were the ministers at the time? Where was Public Security Minister Anne McClellan, who surely must have been informed by the Americans that a Canadian citizen had been given over to Syria? Where was our foreign minister, if memory serves me correctly, was Bill Graham at the time? Why was there no responsibility by the elected officials? I'm not interested in Commissioner Zaccardelli. He's had a long and distinguished career in his proper but pro forma apology. Obviously, the system failed Maher Arar. But why were our political officials not more effective in protecting the rights of Canadian citizens? And there are other cases like this. That is the underlying problem in this. It's not enough for people simply to go up and say, I'm sorry. And those people that are saying, I'm sorry, are not the people who are responsible. This was a political problem, a problem of national will. Stephen Harper's prime minister has set out a new vision of pride and purpose for this country. But part of that is going to have to be to remake that bureaucracy that is so mute and impotent when Canadians get into harm's way abroad. And those questions need to be answered. We're not going to go through the legalities of the Arar case. We've done that before with Julius Gray and with other civil liberties experts. We know the tragic things that happened. But if you're as bothered as I am by the underlying impotence of our government in protecting our citizens abroad, I'd like to hear from you tonight. And we're going to be right back and tell you what we've gone on for the next hour right after this. Been a lot of talk politically that the Prime Minister's stand, his pro-war stand, is going to hurt him potentially in Quebec, hurt his chances for a majority. Well, there's some interesting news that might put the lie to those notions, and we're going to examine that in just a few moments, but I see our lines are blazing and lit up already, so let me just take a few callers first before I introduce her. First, how are you?
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
About the Arar case, I think you're misrepresenting. The true culprits here are agencies like CSIS, who basically want to please the Americans so much that they concocted false evidence. They handed over an innocent person to the Americans.
Okay, Steve.
In the first place.
Steve, you know,
Hold on a minute, Steve.
Steve, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. Nobody's entitled to make up their own facts, Steve. CSIS turned over the file, sadly, turned over these files to the RCMP specifically because they didn't have the resources or the manpower. Now, my question that I led with was, why didn't our government do something with the Americans once they found out that Arar had been sent to Syria?
Well, my whole point being is that these agencies, whether they be CSIS or the RCMP, were, after 9/11, extremely intent on pleasing the Americans in any way, and that's the reason why they sent him over to Syria. They knew he was going to get tortured there, you know. But Steve, that's
not the question I'm posing. First of all, your proposition is illogical. If you want to make America happy, even if that was true, that's not going to make America happy by sending a Canadian to be taken by the Americans to be given to the Syrians, and whom the Americans don't trust at all. You could be right if you were going to say, well, we gave them to the Americans for them to get some information on them. But it doesn't make sense as to why...
But the Americans are the ones who sent them over to Syria because they knew that the Syrians could use torture techniques to try to get information out of them.
But
it's not the first time...
But there is no exchange... Steve, but there is no... Steve, you're right, but there is not the first time innocent people are railroaded, but the Americans and the Syrians have no exchange of intelligence agencies.
Of course they
My
do.
Question... No,
Why
they don't.
Do
my question is...
Dreaming.
My question was, you had a guy, Maher Arar, at Kennedy Airport in New York, right?
Yeah, America, how did he get to Syria?
Exactly. But listen to me.
Sent him there.
But here
they
is...
They deported him
But
to
here,
Syria.
Here is the question. They deported him... But Canada found out about the deportation and made no moves. That's what I'm saying. I'm not talking about the agencies.
How did he get back to Canada then if Canada didn't make the moves? Of course, the Canadian government made some representations
actually, Steve,
on his behalf.
Steve, actually, yeah. I'm sorry, the lines are really going crazy, but it's not even so much a backstory. The front story to this is that the reason why Arar was finally released, together with three other Syrian Canadians, by the way, had more to do with American pressure than Canadian influence. But there's a serious problem here. I'll agree with you on that. Let's go to Carol in NDG. Carol, how are you?
Yes, hi, Beryl.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. It seems to me that our system suffers of...
That what?
Logic. It seems our system and the whole of society suffers from a... apologetical cancer metastatic stage. In plain English, it means that we are always bending down and kissing everybody else's CPR.
It does seem to be that way, isn't it?
Yeah. No, to me, it is this way. It's more and more. It confirms more and more my doubts. It confirms more and more my fears, my apprehensions.
Well, Carol, I wouldn't mind the apologies if we had some answers that come with them. Carol, I've got to cut it short because got to introduce our first guest.
Nice
Thank
evening.
You, Carol. We would ask our callers to be patient and hang on the line because I think you'll be fascinated with this next discussion. As I said earlier, there's all these analyses right now in Canada that Stephen Harper's support for the war is going to cost him in Quebec. Might cost him a majority. Mark Twain once said there are three kinds of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics. And maybe polls are the highest kind of lies, but since we're looking at the negative ones, let's look at a very interesting situation that's developing in the state of Connecticut. Joe Lieberman, vice presidential candidate with Al Gore, lost the Democratic primary, ostensibly to an anti-war challenger named Ned Lamont, decided to run as an independent. Whole bunch of Democrats lined up behind Lamont, thinking they got the message that Americans are anti-war. Republican challenger Representative Alan Schlesinger doesn't seem to be in the picture. And new poll released this morning shows Joe Lieberman leading Ned Lamont by 10 to 11 points running as an independent. And just to analyze the state of the nation and the state of the minds of the voters, is joining us now is Jerry Gordon. And Jerry Gordon has a broad knowledge of Canada, lives in Connecticut, board member, Middle East Affairs Analyst for the American Congress for Truth, a frequent guest and commentator on a variety of shows on television and radio in the United States. He has served in military intelligence in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam era and is on the national boards of HIAS and the New York and Connecticut chapters of the American Jewish Committee. Jerry Gordon, welcome.
Thank you, Burl.
This poll has got a lot of people's attention in Canada. I got about three calls from reporters today saying, hey, did you see this? And I frankly hadn't. And then, of course, I called you to be my guru on this. What does this tell us about the state of voters?
Well, it tells us that you can no longer be a single-issue candidate, even as a Democrat, and win in a general election here in a state that's supposed to be, given the dichotomy in the U.S. So remember that thing from 2004 election, blue states
yep.
versus red states?
Yep.
And Connecticut's supposed to be a blue state. Well, I must tell your listeners in Canada that we think presently that dichotomy is eyewash. And there are some...
Jerry, I'm sorry, they're motioning to me to pay a bill. So hold the thought about the dichotomy being eyewash while we pay some bills to pay for our car washes. We'll be right back with you, okay?
Thanks, Alan.
We'll be right back. We're talking with Jerry Gordon, Connecticut Democratic political board member and Middle East Affairs analyst for the American Congress for Truth. This fascinating poll that Senator Joe Lieberman, the former vice presidential candidate, running as an independent now against Democrat Ned Lamont, has a 7-point lead. And what does that mean here in Canada, and particularly in Quebec, where there's been all this talk about Quebec is anti-war, Quebec is progressive, and Harper might not get a majority because of his pro-war stance? And, Jerry, you were just saying before the break, this is an eyewash dichotomy. Explain.
Well, the eyewash dichotomy here in the United States was the red versus the blue states. The blue states were supposed to be oriented to certain social issues, and, of course, they were supposed to be against the Middle East war, particularly in Iraq and the war on terrorism.
Oh, by the way, we better point out for our listeners in Canada, because in Canada, blue is conservative. So in the States, blue is Democrat. Red is Republican or conservative.
That's
it's the opposite here.
It's the opposite but of what it is in Canada with your blue and red ties.
It's the cold up here, Jerry. It's the cold. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, well, I think what's happened here is that you have the anomaly of a very, very weak Republican contender who none of the GOP is supporting, from the President of the United States to Ken Mellman, who basically is the head of the Republican National Committee,
right,
to the incumbent Republican Governor, Jody Rell. And after the win by Lamont in this August 8th primary, almost immediately all of the extant Republican congressmen who were up for re-election, including some good ones, like, for example, Chris Shays, who is in my district here,
right,
in Fairfield County, basically said, we're for Joe. We want to get on Joe's coattails because he had this enormous popularity and appeal, particularly among independent voters. He also has, as represented by some things I've seen, great appeal to what we used to call lunch bucket Democrats. These are folks who basically work for a livelihood, part of organized labor, and several important union local heads are in fact prominent in Joe's video ads on his website here in Connecticut, which you people can access actually up in Canada.
Right.
I think the real problem that Lamont did is Lamont put on a series of advertisements that just basically blew everybody away. One of them shows a bunch of people walking around with their coats inside out. The code word is, Joe is a turncoat. Well, that blew up in his face like an exploding cigar because that didn't work, period. He's only gained 2 points in a period of almost 6 weeks. And it's unlikely, since 83% of those polled by the particularly solid Quinnipiac University polls down here in the States show that they've already made up their mind in that regard. So it looks like it's going to be increasingly difficult for Ned Lamont, who basically held only one political position before, and that was sort of like a selectman, meaning a councilman, in the Tony suburb of Greenwich, Connecticut.
What is particularly interesting for Canadians, though, in this race is that it's often said that in Canada, the differences between the Conservatives and Liberals are very slight. The Conservatives in Canada would be left-wing Republicans. And here we have a race between Joe Lieberman and Ned Lamont, two Democrats, with differences on the war, but other than that, within the same political spectrum, and There is not that much anti-war sentiment as was thought. And I want to quote something you wrote that's particularly apt to the situation in Canada. And you said that this is me putting words in your mouth, but you'll forgive me.
Okay.
But all those touchy-feely salon liberals who are embarrassed by U.S. prominence in the world, or being, in Canada's case, allied with U.S. prominence in the world, the secular transnationals, may not be as numerous as we thought, may not be as embarrassed as we thought. Is that the lesson that we have to get in Canada from this?
Yeah, I think it is, because basically that comment, that sort of typology that was created by political analyst Michael Barone, who I think is amongst the first rank of political analysts here in the U.S., is very apt in terms of your situation in Canada as it was here. Those secular transnationalists, that sounds like baffle gab, as some folks would say, basically describes a bunch of people who feel that the U.S. is not entitled to become a hegemon for world security. And that has not gone down very well, I think, with independent and particularly GOP voters here.
Jerry, can you expand on that right after this break?
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot. Montreal, we'll be right back. Talking with activist, community activist, member of the American Congress for Truth Board, Jerry Gordon from Connecticut. The Lieberman-Lamont contest for the Senate, that could have great, great lessons for Canada and for Stephen Harper. And Jerry, you were saying before the break, you were talking about secular transnationals, all the touchy-feely guys out there. May not be that many of them. People may be able to get it, or maybe beginning to get it.
Well, I think people are beginning to get it, recognizing that there are other more serious things to take a look at. Let me give your listeners an example of some of Joe's appeal down here. Firstly, it's not lost on us. He's going into a significant term of office. He's got seniority in the Senate, despite the fact that the Democrats are in the minority. He was the co-sponsor of the 9/11 Commission, which begat some interesting revelations and some changes in our national intelligence setup, among others. And he's also, in his own way, kind of a touchy-feely type, because he gave a talk at Fairfield University, not far from me here in Connecticut, in which he introduced a mother of one of the unfortunate young men who died on the 106th floor of the North Tower in what was the World Trade Center. And Joe does his casework, as we call it down here. He makes sure that if A union local is threatened with extinction of its jobs and positions as a result of change in corporate ownership. He will make sure that there is some continuity, as he has in the case of some business units of United Technology here in the state, to make sure that those jobs are preserved. And he's done an amazing job in that task.
Jerry, on this point, we have a litany that's a catechism that's pronounced by the talking heads in Canada, that Canadians never vote in foreign policy. Elections are never won or lost in foreign policy in Canada. I don't know if that's true, but... How true is that in the States on a Senate level?
Well,
foreign affairs make a much bigger difference down there, don't they?
Well, they may make a bigger difference, but the reality is that where Lamont has been pounding away at the question of Lieberman's alleged connection to Bush's strategy on the Iraq War, it's fallen to pieces because everybody has said, look, Lamont has spent more time attacking Joe, and Joe has spent more time essentially explaining what he would do if reelected. And that's a more positive spin based on substance than it is for somebody who's really, for all practical purposes, a wealthy neophyte going up against Joe.
And that's a very interesting point and a very interesting lesson, because that is one thing that all commentators here agree with Prime Minister Harper, who set out for the first time in decades a bold foreign and military vision for this country. He stays on message, he's calm, he's reasoned, and he doesn't get swayed. And maybe that's the lesson to be learned, that you stick to it, you stick to your principles, do some plain speaking, and people eventually get it.
I think that's what's occurred down here, because the Quinnipiac poll clearly indicates that amongst the sample that they've made this month in September, there's less than 6 weeks to go before Election Day on November the 7th, that better than four-fifths of the voters have made up their mind. And if they've made up their mind and Lamont hasn't gained, in fact, he may be on the cusp of losing significant attraction amongst core liberal Democrats, then basically he's already lost, and he spent over $6 million of his own money.
Let him spend it and flush it. It's a good idea. It's a good thing for Lamont to flush it.
Yes,
Jerry Gordon, many thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Melbert, have we got Melbert on the line?
Basically calling about, everybody's talking
Sorry, you better start again. I think our technical gizmos weren't working, so people didn't hear the beginning. Go ahead.
Okay. Like, everybody's trying to be very specific about a problem that is a global problem, and it's a problem related to, everybody wants to be politically correct in terms of what's really going on globally. Globally, we're in a war.
Yeah.
We are in a major
hell,
war.
Melbert, I think I'm politically correct when I say that, and people tell me I'm not. I don't get it.
No, you're right. We are in the beginning of a major war. And being politically correct in terms of who's wrong, who's right, who's, you know, we're talking about a battle that is going to develop over the next 3 or 4 or 5 years. It is comparable to what happened in 1939.
I think we're already there.
We're already there. And, you know, all
my question, Melbert, have you ever asked yourself, to me it's like nails on a blackboard when I hear this, you know, politically correct, and we have to talk and we have to be nuanced. With whom? And about what?
Exactly.
We're going to have the ambassador of Afghanistan on in a few moments. Now, you've got the Taliban, you've got the Iranian mullahs, you've got Hezbollah. I mean, these people are throwing acid in the faces of little girls going to school. These people are jailing and killing trade unionists and socialists. What are we going to talk to them about?
The Nazi mentality.
Exactly. So what, you know, when I hear politically correct, when I hear Jack Jumpin' Jack Flash Layton, what do they want to talk to these people about? These people come to a table, they'll be shot.
They have no idea. They have no idea of what they're dealing with. They just have no idea.
Do you think they're really that stupid, or do you think it's just political opportunism?
It is political opportunism, and it's unfortunate that they would even be at that level. I mean, think globally. Don't think, provincially, nationally. Think globally.
Get out of the box. Get out of your parochial corner.
I mean, this is absolutely disgusting in terms of the, you know, the political opportunism that is being, that is taking place.
Melbourne, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and a great lead-in for our conversation with the ambassador, which will be coming up right after this break. We'll be right back with you, Montreal.
Okay.
Thanks, Melbourne. We're privileged now to welcome Ambassador Omar Samad to Canada. Samad, much for taking the time to join us from a very busy schedule.
Oh, you're welcome. Good evening to you and all your listeners.
It was a pleasure to talk to you before President Karzai's visit. I wanted to talk to you after it. It was a visit that impressed everyone. Did it meet the goals that you personally had wanted to see happen in Canada?
Absolutely. I think that the president was very keen to come to Canada as soon as possible. He obviously knew about the debate that is going on here. He wanted to add his voice on behalf of the Afghan people, to thank Canadians for what they have done so far, to convey his message of sympathy and condolences to the families of those who have lost loved ones and those who have been hurt, to offer them recovery and a speedy recovery. And he did so. He had a chance to meet with some of the families and through them convey to all of them what the Afghan people think. And he also had very good talks here in Ottawa with the present government of Prime Minister Harper. And he addressed Parliament, as most of you may have seen or heard. And
The first leader, by the way, I'd like to just point out to our listeners,
yes,
the first leader since Churchill who addressed both houses of Parliament in Parliament. Exactly. While Canadian troops were fighting abroad.
Exactly. We didn't know that until a day before his address, that he is the second leader to address Parliament during Canadian troops' presence in a combat situation. But I think what the president enjoyed the most was meeting Canadian soldiers in different instances, thanking them for their commitment and their strong will and courage, as well as regular, ordinary Canadians on the street.
Mm-hmm.
He has, obviously, he spent a day in Montreal and a full day in Ottawa.
Yes.
And every occasion he had, he went to the Canadian people on the street. He shook hands, he talked to them, he thanked them. And I think that's exactly what he wanted to do.
He was tremendously eloquent. You are tremendously eloquent. And I know that you have traveled the country. You just got back from the Maritimes.
Yes.
How much did President Karzai's visit here drive home the point of the universality of the struggle that is going on in Afghanistan of helping a sister democracy rise on its feet? Are people getting the message? You heard the previous caller. And you know, sitting at this microphone, I'm hearing more and more Canadians understand that those who oppose our efforts are doing it for political expediency. More and more Canadians seem to be understanding that kind of shared responsibility that we have in everyone's struggle for redemptive change. Are you finding that on the ground in Canada?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, I've been in Canada for exactly 2 years, and the past year, and especially the past 9 months or so, have been extraordinary in terms of the Canadian relationship to Afghanistan and all that it encompasses, and what the Afghan people really want and need and are grateful for. I see very positive changes in Canada in terms of Canada's role on the global stage overall. And I think that Canadians are realizing that they have their own agenda, they have their own interests, they have their own will, and they can express it. And Afghanistan is one such place. But that's for Canadians to decide, and that's for Canadians to pursue, if they wish so, through your democracy and through your system here. Now, obviously, the decision to be in Afghanistan was taken 5 years ago. It's not such a partisan issue because 5 years ago another party was in charge, and then the decision to go to Kandahar was taken almost 2 years ago or so. And again, we see that there's continuation with the new government to support the efforts in Afghanistan because they understand, and I think that that every country that believes in freedom and that believes in democracy and that believes in the ability of people in a country to decide for themselves are in Afghanistan. I mean, look at the number of countries that have troops in Afghanistan. It's unprecedented, and it's not just NATO. It's not just the U.S. It is 37 nations. I was just telling someone yesterday that even the Japanese are helping the efforts in Afghanistan militarily. And then there are more than 60 countries with troops. Now, the president had a chance to talk to all political parties in Canada. I was present when he met with the leadership of the Liberal Party, the NDP, as well as Bloc Québécois. And I think that these discussions were very important because he laid out a broader scenario for them to understand why Afghanistan matters, not from a narrow point of view, not from a partisan point of view, but really from the bigger picture point of view. And I think that all parties agreed with him that the bigger picture is really important for all of us.
Mr. Ambassador, I want you to indulge me for a moment, because this is one of my, a big thorn in my side. When, you know, the leader of the NDP, who I call Jumpin' Jack Flash Layton, what is it going to take for a guy like this, who's not stupid, what does it take to get political expediency out of the game? The shallowness of his suggestion of talking to the Taliban, and I've editorialized about this and I've talked about this, what does a socialist leader, backed by trade unions, have to talk to the Taliban about? How can he even stand in front of the Canadian people knowing that these people, the Taliban would as soon shoot him as shake his hand? How can he? Any human being be so shallow? And did he express any of that, if you can talk about it, in his meetings with the president?
As I said, I think that there were some narrow interpretations and narrow understandings of what Afghanistan is all about and what the history of Afghanistan in the past generation or two is all about and what it means in that region of the world and what it means today for global peace and security. And I think that the president of Afghanistan, during his trip here to Canada, was able to convey that understanding to as many Canadians as he could, including the political parties and including those who have had different variations of understanding. And I believe that Mr. Layton also understood that it's more than just talking to the Taliban, because the president told him, who are the Taliban? Who do I talk to in the Taliban? I mean, is there a structure? Is there an address? Is there a political movement? No. We are talking about ragtag army of militants and mercenaries and terrorists. Do you want me to talk to them? And that's not possible. So if we know who we're talking to, then, you know, maybe we will. But the door is open for anyone from that movement to come and join peace and democracy. And some have. But those who are not and are unwilling to join that, you know, we have to make a stand against them. At the same time, we have to help the Afghans rebuild the nation. And I believe that he agreed with most of these views. And I think he today has a better understanding of the situation in Afghanistan than he did a week ago.
Mr. Ambassador, I think you are one of the most eloquent voices for any country that we have in Canada. And the last word belongs to you, and the last words are words you wrote. Two generations of Afghans were lost to war. We owe it to new generations the world over to provide them with a safer and brighter future. Omar Samad, Ambassador of Afghanistan to Canada, we thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Montreal, we'll be right back with your calls. We're going to start with Andy, who's been very patient. Be back in a moment. Always energized when Ambassador Samad joins us. And to hear voices of eloquence and courage amid such devastation is to make you realize the potential of the human experiment, the potential of the human spirit, and the triumph of that will, what we must be engaged in as Canadians. Thank you for your...
Not too bad. The thing is this, I was listening yesterday, and what the gentleman said yesterday, the Egyptian doctor,
yeah,
he said exactly everything that is factual and true.
Well, he came from the belly of the beast. He was there.
Just a minute. I didn't come from the belly of the beast, but I've been saying that for several years, and people think I'm crazy.
I don't think you're crazy.
Yeah, but the people, well, you don't know the people that I speak to. And that they might be even in position, they don't accept anything. This is what it is. It's the same type of naivety that before World War II, yep, around the 1930s, when Germany was building up the armed forces to such an extent, and nobody realized, nobody wanted to say, hey, what the hell do they need it for?
You know, I was talking to somebody today, a reporter, And we were talking about Afghanistan, and we were talking about just this point, and I said to him, this reminds me of 1938, and to me, after watching President Karzai, for example, I said, I don't want to make too fine a point, but if we don't defend Karzai today and the Karzai regime, it will be the same kind of betrayal as happened with Benesh in the Czech Republic.
Yeah, now, there's another thing. You also spoke about Arar. Actually, what bothers me, not that, look, he fell into the trap, but what bothers me most is that the government official, the political leadership, is not willing to take a stand. And once it has been realized that they made a mistake, they should have done something. On the other hand...
Well, it's not even a matter of leadership, Andy. What is troublesome is that, I mean, let's put this on a very personal level, you know... we're both from Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say we decide to travel back. And something happens out there. There's regime change. Now, if our government doesn't act, if our ministers don't act as they did not act in the Arar case, as they did not act with in the Samson case.
Yeah, the guy who was there in over two years.
In Saudi Arabia, that's right.
I mean,
where's the protection of a government? What are we paying taxes for? What are we this is not a knock on the current government, but Anne McClellan was public security minister. Bill Graham was foreign minister. Samson and Arar languished for 2 years. And we have evidence and testimony that our own diplomatic officials didn't even visit them.
Yeah, and the thing is, even though it has been realized there was a mistake and everything is wrong and shouldn't have happened, they still don't move. That's why I come to the conclusion is that I have no respect for the political of the present political leadership. Harper seems to be not bad. But
I think he's giving us a bold vision. I just hope he gets a majority to be able to enact it.
Thing is, government leader should act even if he's going to be wrong, but he at least acted, and instead of vacillating, and Jack Layton, I must tell you, he is ignorant, he is dumb.
Is he ignorant, or is he just politically expedient?
No, he's dumb, because any person...
Well, if you want to put a name to it, I'm not going to object.
No, but I'll tell you why. Because he's dreaming of becoming the prime minister, which will never happen the way he's acting.
But didn't Graham aggravate you as much as Layton last week? You know, when I saw them after Prime Minister Harper's speech at the UN, which I thought was statesmanlike, and suddenly you had Graham flapping his jaws and Layton flapping and Duceppe's eyes going everywhere. And every week these guys seem to have a new word. You know, you have to be proportional, you have to be nuanced. Last week it was balanced. Harper wasn't balanced enough for him. What does balance mean, Andy?
Yeah, I don't know, but there's only one problem. But they were there before when all the problems were going on, and now they're attacking the government for acting
amazing
on behalf of the country.
It's like every single week we got a new word. Andy, I want to thank you very much for calling. We'll talk to you on the flip side. Thank you very much, Montreal. We'll be back with you next week. And remember, eternal vigilance is what a democracy is built on, because barbarism is not the prehistory of humanity, but its faithful shadow that accompanies its every step if we do nothing. Nick Mays, thank you, and Master Control. Have a good night, everybody.